That is bluegrass virtuoso fiddle player and 2022 National Heritage Fellow Michael Cleveland playing North Carolina Breakdown. And from the National Endowment for the Arts, this is Artworks. I'm Josephine Reed. Born legally blind in 1980 in southern Indiana, Michael Cleveland first picked up a fiddle when he was 4, and it's fair to say the rest is bluegrass history. Known for the speed, intensity, and sheer artistry of his playing, Michael combines a real knowledge of and reverence for earlier bluegrass fiddlers while pushing the music to new places. If you ever wondered how to stay rooted in a tradition while expanding and innovating it, I'd say listen to Michael Cleveland. In fact, let me rephrase that. You should just listen to Michael Cleveland, full stop. He is one of the great fiddlers of his generation. Michael has been recognized 12 times as the International Bluegrass Music Association's Fiddler of the Year, and he was inducted into the National Fiddlers Hall of Fame in 2018. The same year his recording, Fiddler's Dream, was nominated for a Grammy for Best Bluegrass Album, a Grammy he won in 2019 for his album Tall Fiddler. I spoke with Michael Cleveland last week, and while the recording has a couple of slight audio glitches, it is a great conversation with a true master. Let's listen. Well, Michael Cleveland, so many congratulations on being named a 2022 NEA Heritage Fellow. You have played with so many Heritage Fellows: Del McCoury, Doc Watson, Bill Monroe, Jerry Douglas, Andy Statman. Have you played with Ralph Stanley or Wayne Henderson?
Yeah, well, I know Wayne. I got to meet him here in the last few years or so, and I did get to play with Ralph a few times.
Now you're one of them. You're a National Heritage Fellow, and you're absolutely one of the younger fellows ever to receive this award, and I wonder what the award means for you.
Well, it's truly an honor, and I'm very thankful to have been chosen. To John Kay and a lot of the people here in Indiana who have worked really hard to make this happen for me, I'm totally grateful, and I'm still finding out all the people who have won this award, you know, and to be in a list with those people like Ralph and Andy Statman. Andy is a great friend of mine and one of my musical heroes. Jerry Douglas and Bill Monroe, and I mean, I never would have dreamed.
Well, Michael, you come from a bluegrass family. They didn't play, but they sure loved and supported the music. What are your earliest memories of bluegrass?
I'd say my earliest memory of bluegrass would have been just being in the middle of a bluegrass show, you know, because my grandparents went to bluegrass in Indiana all the time. As a matter of fact, you're correct. None of my family play, but my grandparents got into bluegrass a few years before I was born. So my grandparents started a show that eventually turned into a bluegrass association that met every second and fourth Saturday of the month in Henryville, Indiana. There were other shows going on in Madison, Indiana, and Scottsburg, Indiana. So, and when my grandparents weren't working their show, they'd be at all the others, and they would take me. I was about 6 months old, apparently. I don't know that I can remember not being around bluegrass. It might be easier to put it that way.
You know, Michael, I have to say, and I'm really embarrassed to say this, I hadn't realized that southern Indiana was such a hotbed for bluegrass. Talk about that vibrant bluegrass scene when you were growing up.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize, but, you know, Bill Monroe lived in Indiana, and Bill Monroe ended up buying a park in Brown County, Indiana, in a small town called Bean Blossom. And he made that into one of the biggest bluegrass festivals in the country. And that started around 1966. But even before that, I think he bought the Brown County Barn around 1952. And they would have shows there every weekend. And then around 66, 67 is when they started having the bluegrass festivals there every year. They had one in June that ended up eventually going about 10 days, and then they'd have another one in September around the time of Bill Monroe's birthday, and that'd be like a weekend thing. So you had those, you had the Bean Blossom Festival. There was a ton of bluegrass. Like, there's a ton of great musicians here. A lot of them, never did go out and play for a living. They could have, and they all had families and real jobs and all that kind of thing. But now there's a lot of bluegrass around this area.
It's hard to make a living in music, let's face it. You were born completely blind, and your parents sent you to the Kentucky School for the Blind when you were quite young. Can you talk about the experience of going to school there and what that school did for you, both personally and professionally?
Well, I guess I should have went to the Indiana School for the Blind because I live in southern Indiana, but the deal was Indianapolis is about 100 miles away, and Louisville was about 20, 25 miles away. And my parents didn't really want to send me that far to Indiana. The School for the Blind helped me a lot in the sense that, I was around other people who were visually impaired dealing with the same things, and to see how they excelled and did pretty much anything they wanted to do, that was huge. But I never did necessarily like school. I was always thinking about music. And I did pretty well in school, I didn't flunk out or anything, but I mean, my head was always in music. But you go to the school Sunday night, and you'd stay in the dorm until Friday. And then you would go home Friday and Saturday, and then you'd be back on Sunday. So that was pretty hard for me to get used to, because I had never really been away from home, and I was 4 years old when I went. Obviously, I know now it couldn't have been easy for my parents, but that was kind of hard to get used to.
Oh, I can bet it was. I was sent away to boarding school when I was 12, and it was hard at 12. I can only imagine it at 4. But the school had a really rich music program, didn't it?
Yeah, it had a strings program, which is what I started on. And then I also had, band. We had a great band, man. At one point, we had a band that would play all the pep rallies. It was a great rock band. And then we had strings and choral and, about everything else you could think of. I figured out I wanted to play the fiddle. I'd heard somebody play Orange Blossom Special, and that just rocked my world. And I knew that I had to learn how to play that song. And I don't know what it was. Thinking back on it now, I don't know if it was all the train sounds or, obviously the speed of it. I've always been a big fan of that. And just the energy of bluegrass. I think that's what always did it for me, the energy and the intensity in which people play. So, I started when I was 4, and I started taking classical, and the Suzuki method is what they taught. So that's a great way for kids to learn who are just starting to play. The main thing that it did, we all learned by ear, even, learning classical. It was great ear training to be able to listen to that stuff, try to figure out what was actually going on. Yeah, so that's kind of how I got started.
Well, I didn't realize that because of an early illness, you have an 80% hearing loss in your left ear. And I wonder how that impacted both your learning, but also your playing today.
Well, I'm not sure. It's kind of like when people ask you, what do you think, how do you think your blindness affected your music or anything else? I was going to play regardless of whether I could hear in my left ear or not. I was just bound and determined to do it. It's definitely challenging even now, you know, like now that we have a sound man and we have in-ear monitors, it doesn't really matter too much where I stand. But if I'm sitting in with somebody and playing, you know, I prefer to be kind of on the left side or the right end of the stage, looking at it from the audience point of view, to where everybody's on my right. You know, and one of the guys in my band said one time that he thought that's why I played so hard, is just because the fiddle was right under my left ear, and, you know, he thought if I had hearing that I probably wouldn't play as hard as I do. And maybe so, but aggression, that intensity, you know. So I don't know. It's very interesting.
It certainly is. Was the school opened at all to you playing bluegrass? I know they taught classical, but, you know, they also had various other music programs as well. Did they encourage bluegrass?
Not really. And I think a lot of it, you know, they did have my best interest at heart. But, yeah, the music teacher that I had probably heard a bad example of bluegrass, you know, or whatever, and they really didn't want me playing it, and they thought it was going to hurt my playing, and the rest of the people in school, you know, they just kind of looked down on it. It's like bluegrass, it was like some kind of a joke or something. Until I got to be about 16, 17 years old and started doing more and more things, and they figured out, oh yeah, well this might actually be real, you know. I think what happened is I had entered this contest for Very Special Arts. It was an organization that showcased people with various disabilities, and they had a contest that you could enter. I ended up winning that, and they asked me to do some local things around the Louisville area for Very Special Arts, and then they were gonna meet before Congress in D.C. And they asked me, and I took my friend Brian with me, and we went to D.C., and before and after the meeting, we played like a couple tunes while everybody was walking in, and a couple more while everybody was leaving. And so we played before Congress, and for whatever reason, the teachers at my school, all of a sudden, it was like a big turnaround. It's like, oh yeah, this might actually be real. You know, he might actually do something. But, you know, in their defense, I mean, there's so many musicians out here. And there's so many people trying to do the same thing. And sometimes it really doesn't even matter how good you are, if you're not at the right place or at the right time. So I get the fact that they would say, you know, you need something else to fall back on. Yeah, so I do understand.
In terms of the culture of bluegrass music, this is a music that's really passed down and taught within communities. Isn't that correct? It seems like there's a music, there's no us, there's no them. There's such little separation between the people on the stage and the people in the audience.
Yeah, that's one of the great things about it, is so much of what you learn and what just about everybody learns is just from being there, being in front of somebody playing the lick you want to learn. And that's the cool thing about this music, is all the people on stage. I mean, you can meet your favorite bluegrass stars. If you're at a bluegrass festival, most of the bands will be set up, have a merch table or whatever, and it's very easy to talk to these people. And then night after the shows are over, there's usually a lot of jam sessions going on, and you probably run into some of the people you see or you watch on stage in the jam. So that was something that I really liked about the music, you know, is that you could go up to your hero, and most of the time, they would tell you exactly how they did whatever it was, you know. I don't think you can get that in about any other kind of music.
Tell me how you learned bluegrass. So it wasn't happening at your school, and your grandparents were taking you out to lots of festivals, and they had a great collection of bluegrass. How did you actually learn it?
Well, It was a very slow process. Now that the school, it was weird. Like they didn't want me playing bluegrass, but they did have these books of fiddle tunes, which are pretty much bluegrass. My teacher showed me a simple version of Boil the Cabbage Down, which is one of the first tunes and one of the simplest tunes you could learn starting out playing fiddle. Boil the Cabbage Down, Old Joe Clark. And so I think I only knew that maybe those two tunes. And I've been playing for a couple, 3 years at this point. You know, it's probably 2 years before I got going playing anything. It's pretty slow. Once I got to where I could play real simple versions of these tunes, we were going to all these bluegrass shows anyway. I just started taking my fiddle, and there were a lot of people around that took time to show me what they knew. And this has always blown my mind. I've never been able to figure it out. So the best bands that would come to the bluegrass shows, you know, I could always stand in the background and play. And I mean, I know I was god awful. I was just god awful. Just trying to learn how to play, you know, a little kid scratching around. And I mean, the best bands would let me play with them. And the worst bands would let me play with them. But the mediocre ones, no way. I never did figure that out.
You were a baby at this
Oh,
point.
yeah.
You were what, 7 years old, maybe?
Probably so.
Yeah. You've always talked about how you've always been curious, eager to learn about the fiddle and ask questions and learn the history of a song, to unravel it through the people who are playing it now, but who they learned it from. And
Right.
you could have been a bluegrass historian. I mean, you still could be, for all I know. Talk about why that was so important to you.
Well, I think I was already very interested in the music, and when I was about 12 years old, I played a festival of fiddlers gathering in Battleground, Indiana. And one of the guys that helped put it on, Dave Samuelson, who I didn't really know at that time, he came up to me and he said, "You know, I'd like to give you some music sometime that I think you need to listen to." And I said, "Okay, well, that'd be great, you know." And I didn't really think too much more about it. I thought, well, you know, I'll probably never hear anything from him again, you know. And then I played another festival a few months later in northern Indiana, and here he was. And he had a big box of tapes. Now, this guy was sighted, okay? He had a box of tapes that he had braille labeled. I mean, we're talking probably 20 something tapes the first time. And it had everything from the first recordings of Orange Blossom, Sally Gooden, you know, all the classic fiddle tunes. It had Bill Monroe, Earl Scruggs, live radio shows, Opry shows that you wouldn't hear. You don't buy this stuff. You find a recording somebody has, like all this stuff. And then there was Stefan Grappelli, Joe Venuti, all the jazz fiddle players, country players like Dale Potter, Tommy Jackson, all this stuff, man. And not only was it the music, before every recording that he played, he would talk about it. And he would say, "You know, listen to this part of the recording. And you'll hear the same thing that Chubby Wise played on this Bill Monroe recording. You know, that he actually got from Stefan Grappelli. Or, you know, I know you like Bobby Hicks is playing. Listen to Dale Potter, and you can tell where Bobby Hicks got a lot of his stuff." So that I think Dave Samuelson is responsible for me getting into all the history of it. That right there, you know, I'm truly grateful to Dave for opening so many doors for me.
Well, Michael, you learn a song and there's learning the notes, but then there's the heart of the song, the essence of the song, and also the heart that you bring to that song. And I'm curious, how you learned about bringing your own heart into the music?
Boy, that's a very good question.
And I don't even mean if it was a conscious learning, but just allowing yourself to do it, perhaps.
Yeah, if it was something I was really into playing, I don't think I ever had any trouble expressing that. But I know what you mean. I'm not saying that I automatically started doing it, you know, and that's a very good question.
Right, because when you're a kid, it's like, wow, I got this. I got the song right.
And you play it, and you play it like a robot. Yeah. Oh,
right.
I know. I don't know. Just thinking about it right now, all the people that I was around playing bluegrass, they all kind of had their own personality. And, yeah, I always like listening to the different fiddle players, local fiddle players, and hearing how they... It's like, oh yeah, they played that. They listened to this record and they learned it. I guess what I'm trying to say is bluegrass is not a written music, even though you can buy a tablature. I guess I was always used to being around bluegrass people and how they played and how they were different from each other. And they're all pretty much stylists. So I guess that's the thing. If I had just played classical music, I would have probably had a much harder time doing that. But me, I think just growing up around people who never did learn by music, you know, and all they did learn was by ear or by watching other people. And they put their personality into the music by pretty much no other choice.
It's just so much a part of the music itself.
It is.
How old were you when you began playing at festivals?
So as far as being up on stage, that was one of the things my grandparents' show and all these other shows around here. So I was on stage, I think, the first time a band got me up on stage to play my one song, Boil the Cabbage Down, that I knew. I think I was about 6 or 7. I started going to contests around the time I was 7, 8, 9, you know. Yeah, I guess I went to a couple bluegrass festivals early on, but mostly just local stuff. And then I went to Bean Blossom. My grandparents took me there when I was 9. And I got to play with Bill Monroe. They had this thing called the Sunset Jam, where they would set up some microphones by this oak tree, and anybody who was in the park who wanted to play with Bill Monroe, they could do it. So I did that, and I guess those were about the first things that I did that was really outside of just the local stuff here around Henryville. And then probably the first real big thing where I was, I guess, maybe introduced in a way to the bluegrass community was when I was about 13, a guy named Pete Warnick called me. And Pete was the banjo player in a great bluegrass band, a very popular bluegrass band called Hot Rise. And he was also the president, vice president of the International Bluegrass Music Association. And Pete had read an article that somebody wrote in the Washington Post that basically said that bluegrass was dying. There were no kids getting interested in the music. So Pete decided he wanted to prove that article wrong. So he was looking for a band. He was wanting to put a band together of kids. He, I guess, had heard of me. He had the guitar player Cody Kilby, and the mandolin player was Chris Thiele, and then Josh Williams on the banjo. And my buddy Brady Stockdale from here in Indiana played bass. He put together this band of kids, and we played International Bluegrass Music Association Awards show. And it was a pretty big deal because everybody was there. Like, IBMA Awards show is considered the biggest night in bluegrass. So you had everybody from Alison Krauss to Jimmy Martin to, you know, anybody you could think of sitting out in the audience. And so I would say that was the first time that I actually played in front of a lot of the bluegrass community. And then that was recorded on a video. Some of that was released on a video called Gather at the River. I guess that was some of the first things.
And is that where you met Doc Watson?
Yep. Right after the awards show, my dad and I were walking around, and of course, this is the first time I'd ever been to anything this big. And all the people who I listened to and dreamed about meeting or playing with were all in this venue. And so I was like a kid in the candy store and just running around everywhere. We were looking for jams. And my dad and I went into this big bathroom. And in this bathroom was Doc Watson, Tim O'Brien, Dan Crary, all these people just jamming in the bathroom. My dad, I think, asked them if I could play with them. And they said, yeah, sure, you know. And I remember I wanted to play Black Mountain Rag with Doc. And it was like, wow, you know, here I am playing Black Mountain Rag with Doc Watson. Yeah, we got in about a 30-40 minute jam session, and they just happened to be videoing for this documentary. Even when I started playing with Dale Ann Bradley when I was about 18 and really started going to all these places, I found out how many people had actually seen that video. Because I had people coming up to me, it's like, man, I saw you on that video with Doc. I still have people to this day. I got you on a video at my house playing with Doc Watson.
And you're talking to somebody else who actually saw that too. And when, aside from your playing, which was extraordinary, what I kept thinking was, where did this kid get this confidence? You were so confident.
I was so stupid. I didn't know any better.
You came to the attention of Alison Krauss, and she brought you to the Grand Ole Opry, and you were 13. Tell me about that experience. Were you nervous?
Yeah, I guess I was. We had went to see Alison Krauss at a local show and talked to her for a little bit, and she had seen me play that performance at IBMA, and I had met her there, and then she had just been made a member of the Grand Ole Opry. So then, I don't know how long after it was, but I came home from school one Friday afternoon, and phone rings, and I pick it up, and this voice on the other end says, "Hey, Michael, it's Allison." I said, "Allison who?" She said, "Allison Krauss. The band and I wanted to ask you if you would play the Grand Ole Opry with us on November 27th. I'll never forget. November 27th, 1993. That's when it was. And I got to go to the Opry, hang out backstage, see Bill Monroe, you know, Allison and the band. They were picking back there. I think I was just wired. I don't think I was nervous. I was wired. I think I drove everybody nuts that day. It was a blur, you know. You got all this anticipation leading up to it. And it's still this way. Whenever you play the opera, you play one or two songs, and it's over like that. Man, I'll never forget it. I'll never forget that first time. And I'm very thankful to Alison Krauss for making that happen.
Well, you graduate from high school and you decide you're going to play professionally. And you played with Dale Ann Bradley, as you said, and then Rhonda Vincent. And I'm curious what you learned about playing in the same band consistently and about being a professional musician from them, as well as how to play to a crowd.
Yeah, playing with Dale Ann and playing with Rhonda were great in a number of ways. One of which, musically, was how to play in keys like E-flat or A-flat or C-sharp or, you know, keys that guys don't normally sing in, that women, you know, their voices tend to work better in those keys, depending on what the song is, obviously. And so being able to learn how to play in those keys and to really back up a singer, to play what fits a song versus throwing every lick you know in there. To look beyond that and find something that complements what the singer is doing without being in the way. And so that's one thing that I learned. And then, you know, playing with Rhonda. Rhonda is great at working a crowd and knowing what the audience wants at any given time. And so with Rhonda, you might have a set list written out, but it could change at a moment's notice. Those were a few things I learned. And then, you know, there's just the fact that when you play in a band with four or five other people, you know, everybody's got their own personalities. Everybody's got their own quirks and things like that. So you just figure out not only how to play the music and, you know, how to cut the gig, but to get along and be around five other crazy musicians.
Well, you came out with a solo album in 2002. What were you, all of 22, 21?
Yep.
Called Flamekeeper. So first, Flamekeeper, that obviously is a word that means something to you because it's also the name of your current band. What attracts you to that?
Well,
name?
That name came from the president of Rounder Records, which was the label that album came out on, and he suggested that name. And I think it fits, you know, because we were, and we still do, you know, pay tribute to the people who set the standards of bluegrass. Bill Monroe, Flat Scruggs, Jimmy Martin, Stanley Brothers, and people like that. But what we're doing more now is, you know, we still play that way, but we also add our own elements to it and try to take it in sort of a new direction at times without losing those traditional elements. That's very important to me. It's not necessarily just fiddle music, it's bluegrass music, and, you know, paying tribute to the people who created the music, but yet still adding your own personality and elements and energy to it.
You formed your own band called Flamekeeper in 2006. What did you want to do with your band? What did you want to do as a leader you weren't able to do as a band member?
Well, that's a very good question because I never really wanted to be a band leader. I had definite ideas about music, you know, and how it should go and how it should sound, and I knew the music that I liked to play. What actually started it was that Dale Ann wasn't working a whole lot. Summer was coming up. I think this was like 2005, 2006. She didn't have a lot of dates, and I wanted to play. I had released that Flamekeeper album, and then the Ragged Edge, and then Let Her Go Boys. And these all came out while I was playing with Dale Ann. And they won some awards. So they had gotten some recognition through the bluegrass community. So around 2006, when we didn't have a lot going that summer, I was talking to some of the guys who played on the Flamekeeper and the Let Her Go Boys album, Audie Blaylock, Jesse Brock, and a great bass player, Jason Moore. And the thing that made those albums is not just my playing, but the way those guys played. You know, you go listen to Flamekeeper and Let Her Go Boys, and listen to the groove. Listen to how those guys played together, and it was a great band. Like, I got in a jam with those guys, and it was just like a spiritual awakening. I didn't know music could be that tight, that together. So that's kind of how it started. And there was a guy that we started working with, Jim Rowe, who was a booking agent. And he saw this Flamekeeper band play a showcase or something. And he came up to me and he said, "This is what you need to be doing." And so he started booking us. Naturally, there were a couple of changes in players because, you know, not everybody could do it. And that's how the band got started.
For you as a player, can you talk about the differences between jamming, rehearsing, performing, and recording?
All right. Well, I mean, to me, a jam is kind of a free-for-all. You know, you're just playing. You're playing for fun. And a jam is usually where some of the best music happens because there's no pressure in a jam. And everybody can hear really well in a jam. You got everybody, you know, in a circle or whatever and playing. And it's the greatest thing in the world.
Is it your favorite way to play?
Yeah, I think so. Now, rehearsal, you're going to play the same song a lot. Over and over and over again. And you go through each part of the song that's not to your satisfaction. And you play that part and work on it and figure out how to improve on it. You play the stuff until you can play it in your sleep.
I guess it's different from recording. With recording, you have to be much more on it because it's studio time and all the expense involved with the producer, etc.
See, the thing is, recordings, yeah, you do have to be on. I mean, you do have to know it, be able to play it, but man, studio recording is easier now than it's ever been. You know, it's so easy now to fix things. And most of the time now when you record, you might have the band all in the studio, but everybody's separated. So you all play on headphones and you'll be in your space so you can hear each other. But what this enables you to do is to be able to fix individual parts. So in that way, recording is much easier.
And what about performing?
Well, the best way I know how to describe a performance, because it's totally different energy. It's like you work and you practice and you get it to that point where you know the music and where you're comfortable with it. And then you get out on stage and whatever happens, happens. That's the best way I know how to describe it. But the energy of the crowd, that's the big thing on stage. When you hear the crowd really getting into it, that's the best feeling in the world. And that's what can take it to another level. You know, if the musicians, if everybody's playing good and feeding off each other, the sound's good, you can hear what you're doing, and the crowd's really into it, There's no better.
I need to talk about some of your other awards. The International Bluegrass Music Award, Fiddler of the Year, 12 times. Flamekeeper won Instrumental Group of the Year, 7 times. I mean, you're being voted on by your fellow musicians. That has got to mean a lot to you.
It does.
And then you were nominated for a Grammy Award for Best Bluegrass Album for Fiddler's Dream. And then you won in 2019 for your album Tall Fiddler. So first, let's talk about winning that Grammy Award and what that experience was like for you.
I was really hoping. I thought I had a pretty good shot at it. But, you know, you never know. And I remember when my name was called, it's like it almost didn't register. I just sat there. I was pretty shook up. I think I got up on stage and I thanked people who weren't even on the album. I had a whole list of names and people to thank and everything, and man, practice it and all that. And once I got up there, man, that all just went out the window.
Well, the people you had on that album was extraordinary. I mean, you had Del McCoury and the McCoorys. You had Jerry Douglas, Bella Fleck, Tim O'Brien. It was a who's who of bluegrass musicians.
Yeah.
How did that album come together, and how did you choose what to play and who to play it with?
A lot of albums for me come together slowly. You know, sometimes I have a complete vision of what the album's going to be or whatever, but most of the time, It doesn't start out that way. And it starts out with a song. In my case, the Tall Fiddler, I just downloaded the Tommy Emmanuel album because I like Tommy's guitar playing. His very first song on it was a fiddle tune. And I could tell, even though it was just him playing it on the guitar, I knew it was a fiddle tune. And that was the Tall Fiddler. And come to find out, the reason Tommy wrote it and who it was written about was a great fiddle player named Byron Burline. And Byron was a legend in bluegrass fiddle. We recently lost him. And so I heard that and I thought, man, I know that's a fiddle tune. I wonder if he's ever recorded that with a fiddle player. And then there were other songs that the band and I had been playing. I got to write a song with Bela Fleck, which I never thought I'd be able to do. Yeah, it was a fun album in the sense that playing with so many people, it was almost like a jam session.
How much music do you write yourself?
I've written quite a few things. It's probably something that I should do more.
Do you like writing music?
I do. I have to get my head in that space because I'll get into playing, if the band's playing a bunch out on the road, and I'll be all into that. And I record a lot at home on other people's music. People send me tracks to play on. Sometimes it's not conducive to writing tunes. A lot of times it's so weird for me. Sometimes when I'm not trying to write a song, like I'll get a piece of something in my head and think, man, that's really cool. And that's usually how it starts. Very rarely has it worked out that I've sat down and said, okay, I'm going to write a song. I can usually come up with something, but the best songs for me, like, maybe you'll wake up and you'll have something in your head. A little piece of a melody line or something. It's very important to record all that, and that's one of the things, the iPhone, man, you can record those voice memos. I bet I got 10 million voice memos on my phone, just little pieces of songs. And some of them haven't done anything with, and a lot of times I like to go back and find those, see if I can make something out of it. But yeah, writing is something I want to learn more about and do more of. It's just writing with other people and see how they go about it. Like Bela Fleck, I mean, it's just endless ideas. Okay, you don't like that idea? How about this? See what you think of this. And it's something totally different. Yeah, that's kind of my writing process.
Looking forward, I wonder what you might have to say to younger bluegrass musicians as they're learning this music.
If I had to say anything to somebody trying to learn bluegrass, I would say, first and foremost, it's got to be fun. It's got to be something you enjoy doing, and to really be good at it, music or anything else, it's got to be something that you just can't not do or can't not think about. If I'm not playing music, chances are I'm thinking about music. But the thing is to have fun, never lose sight of what you put into the music. It's very important to learn the songs, fundamentals, and the correct way to play the music, but you gotta have you in there. And if you can do that, then in my opinion, you're a musician.
And then my final question, and we've talked about this around it a lot, but I wonder for you on a very personal level, what does bluegrass music mean to you?
Oh man, that's a hard question. It shouldn't be. Bluegrass music to me is community, is family, is energy, intensity, and so many other things. Bluegrass music in general, it's my life. It's all I ever wanted to do and all I think about.
Hey, I think that's a great place to leave it. Michael, thank you so much for giving me so much of your time.
Yeah, thank you.
And so many congratulations.
Well, thanks. It's truly an honor.
That was bluegrass fiddler and 2022 National Heritage Fellow, Michael Cleveland. You can keep up with Michael at michaelclevelandfiddle.com. And here's a heads up. We're celebrating all of the amazing 2022 National Heritage Fellows on November 17th, when we'll premiere a film that documents their extraordinary work. Check out our website, arts.gov, for more information as the date approaches. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a rating on Apple. It helps people to find us. And let us know what you think about the Artworks podcast and suggest somebody we should speak to by emailing us at artworkspod@arts.gov. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm Josephine Reed. Thanks for listening.